Hey everybody, this is Matilda Swana from Black and Brown in Bioethics, and you are listening to the Power and Privilege in Academia podcast, the show that gets together with academics, question academic hierarchies, structures, and conventions, unpack their inherent issues, and find solutions together. Today, we're talking about anti-racism within higher education establishments with Hend Rashid and Princess Manda. Hend is a medical doctor who instigated change by founding a race equality working group within the University of Sheffield's Medical School and wrote a paper on strategies to tackle racial inequalities in medical school. Princess is doing a DPhil at the University of Oxford, looking at the intersections of medical anthropology, women's health, social justice. She's very active in increasing the profile of Black maternal health inequalities, decolonizing the curriculum, and is a member of the Institute of Medical Ethics Postgraduate Student Council. We'll discuss how we define anti-racism, racial disparities in higher education, and championing anti-racism in academic institutions. Thanks for joining us, Princess and Hend. Would you like to start with a little bit about yourselves?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. Well, to begin with, I'm an anthropologist, specifically a socio-medical anthropologist, and I feel like whenever I say that, people are like, what does that mean? I'm a medical anthropologist, so I'm interested in health and well-being from an anthropological perspective. But in that, in my analysis, in my critique, in my methods, I take much more of a sociocultural approach. I'm interested in the kind of social factors, political factors, historical factors, I guess the kind of quote unquote soft factors that help determine health, inequity, injustice, all of those things. And as a socio-medical anthropologist, I'm specifically interested in anthropologies of racism, anti-Blackness, and their intersections with health justice and health injustice. I'm a PhD student. I should have probably led with that. And my thesis is currently all about Black maternal health in the UK. So for those who don't know, Black women in the UK are 3 times more likely to die during childbirth. Yeah, and really just understanding how obstetric racism in the UK is really all about biopolitics and now bioethics, which leads me to why I'm on this podcast and why I've recently joined the Postgrad Bioethics Committee as just a member. And so I'm really excited about that as well.
I'm Hend. I'm an F1 doctor and I'll be an F2 in August. So I'm almost done a year of being a doctor. So while I was in med school, I did a lot of anti-racism. Well, I tried to do a lot of anti-racism work, kind of like looking at the curriculum, trying to decolonize in inverted commas, and just generally looking at med students' experiences in med school and just improving it generally. So yeah, we can go into what we did as we get on. I co-chaired the working group for decolonizing the med school and EDI stuff. And I also founded BAME Medic Society. So just a society for students kind of to get together and be represented and have a safe space. So yeah.
Just want to add, and did a presentation at the Institute of Medical Ethics, and that's how we met. I felt really inspired by it last year, just to see.
Oh, thank you.
Kind of like, you know, it's really rare to see a bottom, like what they call like a bottom up approach, where it is really like coming from the students. That was really inspiring.
Oh, thanks.
I'm just like, we have to throw that in there so everybody knows. So just want to start with defining anti-racism. So I decided to Google anti-racism, and the first link I clicked on was Wikipedia. This was the first paragraph that came up. Anti-racism encompasses a range of ideas and political actions which are meant to counter racial prejudice, systemic racism, and the oppression of specific racial groups. Anti-racism is usually structured around conscious efforts and deliberate actions which are intended to provide equal opportunities for all people on both an individual and systemic level. As a philosophy, it can be engaged in by the acknowledgement of personal privileges, confronting acts, as well as systems of racial discrimination, and or working to change personal racial biases. What are your thoughts about this definition and how does it make you feel?
Yeah, I think the main thing that sticks out to me is all the active language, countering, conscious efforts, deliberate actions, that kind of thing. It's about just active, like doing something about it. And I think that's really important because in our institutions, yeah, everybody's jumped onto this statement of, I'm anti-racist, but do they really know what that is? Are they actually, it's actions, not words, really. It's taking it into every facet of your life and your professional life. I like the definition.
Yeah. I think, I certainly appreciate the part about ideas, anti-racism being, an actual philosophy, as in, like, it's a way of actually being and living and doing, right? As so 100%. Not words. I think that building on what Kim has said, I think that like there's this assumption that anti-racism is this kind of like tick box exercise, right? And so I think a lot of people have this like one-time fix all approach where I think that if they say or do a quote unquote anti-racist thing one time, then that means that they have this badge, right? And that they are now kind of anti-racist hero. However, it doesn't work like that. And so, yeah, I certainly appreciate, actual, I guess, inclusion of it being a kind of multifaceted, multi-tiered thing. So, yeah, so I'd say I think it's a good kind of beginner definition. However, this is me being critical here, but I do think I do take slight issue with it, with this use of like of equality is instead of equity, because I think that a lot of times people use equity and equality as these interchangeable things, whereas they're actually not, that they are distinct, right? And I think that I do think that this kind of misunderstanding of quality instead of equity is also why, in my opinion, a lot of people's ideas of anti-racism truly kind of piecemeal, right? Like they are half kind of bait, but it's this image, and it was so I think I saw it on Twitter first. Oh, I want to say around 2020, obviously, with the actual boom of anti-racist language. And yes, I think I saw it around 2020/2021, and it really, to me, encapsulated the whole difference between equity and equality. So essentially, it showed a picture of these people. So it was like a tall man, a child, a medium-sized person, and they were, I think, at like a sports game, and in front of them was fence, it kind of blocking their sight, and it basically showed equality to be everyone receiving the same height, like stool, right, to actually stand on, right? And so and so then what occurred was that, sure, everyone got the same tool, but there was still, I guess, disparity in sight, right, between the tall man and the short child, right? And then it showed a picture of an equity. In this picture, the tall man was actually, I think, given a short stool, and then like everyone else actually received a stool, I guess, like according to the height, for everyone to actually see the same, right? And so again, and so like I guess like in my interpretation, in my viewing, I really saw the actual difference between equity and also equality to be that the resources given are conceptually the same, but kind of tailored to like each person's need. I saw a kind of update on this picture, right? And this update included liberation, right? And so I guess liberation was portrayed to be the like fence actually knocked down, right? And so obviously these people didn't need tools to actually see the sports game. And so again, I think that equality, it's fine, but like it's not always the most appropriate thing. And so yeah, I do think that, like, within our, I guess, understandings and our interpretations of anti-racism, I think that collectively we have to be more specific and kind of fine-tune what these specific words mean, right? And so like equality and equity and also liberation, right? Like these things obviously are related, but they're not interchangeable. They mean slightly different things. So I think the definition is fine, it's okay. Like I think it's a great like introduction, but I think if we want to kind of think deeper, and we kind of want to kind of like fine-tune what we kind of understand anti-racism to be, then we do have to be more specific about how language used to define and also describe what anti-racism means, looks like, what it feels like, etc., etc.
I love this idea, this equity, equality, liberation.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, I noticed the equality thing as well. And Princess's points were great. And I know the image you're talking about is so
Cool.
I was just at a conference where someone used it to explain, you know, the whole, you know, anti-racism and equality. Justice. And I think with the context, you know, of now, I'm not sure if you guys know, but I've seen a lot of talk on Twitter in America. They're getting rid of affirmative action, for example, university applications. And that is a way where people can say equality, but it actually be a step backwards in the process of racism, because there's a reason that affirmative action was needed. And when looking into affirmative action, it was found that white women benefited the most out of it. So in a way, affirmative action was a way of doing the equity bit, but justice would have been maybe removing fees for university or removing people's names and their backgrounds and stuff from applications. I don't know, but like the idea is like it's more than that. It's more than just ticking something off a box, like Princess said, or making sure that you meet a certain quota, because at some point somebody's going to come along and say, actually, that's not equal opportunities. Yeah. So we're going to take that away, and then we suffer again. So people suffer again.
I think this is like quite topical because you've both mentioned something. So Princess mentioned 2020 and was referring to what happened with George Floyd, and Hen, you've mentioned affirmative action and what's happened recently with the Supreme Courts in the US. So this leads quite nicely into my next question around these definitions and the context in terms of what happens in the US and the UK. So when I went on from looking at Wikipedia, I got sucked into a black hole. I then decided to go straight to the reference source that was in Wikipedia, which was the National Museum of African American History and Culture, which is much more detailed definition, and it lists out different categories. It defines them and gives an example of each one. So these are individual racism, referring to beliefs, attitudes, and actions of individuals; interpersonal racism, so between individuals, such as public expressions of racism; institutional racism, so that occurs in an organization; and structural racism, so the overarching system of racial bias across institutions and societies. So just thinking about like what we've already been talking about and this new kind of reference source that I've just mentioned, does racism take several forms, and to kind of what extent can these definitions be applied beyond the African American context?
Yeah, great questions. Firstly, yes, agree. We've known this for a long time. You know, there's been so much work, you know, especially around like scholars, you know, the world racism. It doesn't look one way, right? Like, you know, even though racism is very much a global phenomenon, it does, you know, I do think that kind of takes slightly nuanced forms in different contexts around the world. But yeah, I do think that, you know, overall we can say that, you know, that it does exist in these kind of three ways, and maybe more, right? Who knows? But yes, 100%. It's not just one thing. It's not just name calling. You know what I mean? It is structural. It is institutional. It is political. It's social. It's in terms of the wage gap. You know, it's this intersectional thing. So 100%. I think like one thing I think I've been thinking about a lot recently. Well, to be honest, that's a lot. Not recently. I mean, really since starting my degree. So I started my degree in 2016, right? And I'm thinking about anti-racism even then, even though I was still young. It wasn't, you know, this whole like language of anti-racism just did not exist. But what did exist was this kind of transmission of these ideas about race and also racism from the state. And I think that there's so much brilliant work and brilliant language and just brilliant thinking coming from the state. Like, as like a side note, I do think that especially here in the UK, we do need to be careful to not just apply to not just import and apply without, you know, kind of tailoring, you know, and without, you know, kind of applying things relative to context and also Britain's histories, right? And so I think 100% I have no qualms or no problem with this particular thing. But like, I do just think that these quote-unquote Mexican-American like, terms and stuff, we have to like take care. And I think we have to kind of, yeah, I think we have to flesh out which things about race and blackness and identity and politics, oppression, historical oppression like, are kind of, you know, a part of the quote-unquote black subject's identity in this quote-unquote like post-colonial world versus things which kind of are specific to the American text. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. And I think it is important to name them because, you know, when we're having these conversations, if we talk about racism, I think the majority of the public still thinks racism is being called a slur on the street and that's it. And if they don't do that to you, then they're not part of the problem. If they don't use these slurs, that means that they're not, you know, racist or engaging in racism or any of that stuff. And to kind of speak from my own experience as a Muslim woman. So for context, I am visibly Muslim, so I wear a hijab. And I believe Islamophobia is racialized because not only Muslims are victims of Islamophobia. If you wear a turban, for example, and you're Sikh, you can be victim to Islamophobic hate crimes and things like that. So growing up, yes, I did experience some individual racism, but it pales in comparison to interpersonal racism. You know, growing up and being on the internet, especially post 9/11, and just seeing the absolute hatred and the violence with which people spoke about Muslims, that had affected me way more. So, you know, that does kind of feed into the institutions because these institutions are made up of people. And our systems, our structures are built from colonialism. So there's just no escaping it and being able to name that just helps in dismantling these things. And in terms of how it can be applied beyond the African-American context, like, you know, going off what Princess said, it's so important that we look at the great thinkers from the Black liberation movements in America and apply it here, but we have to look at the British context as well and how that is different. And I think, for example, this is such a random example, but I remember seeing in a hospital canteen, it was Black History Month, so they, first of all, did a lot of things where they changed up the menu and used like West African and Caribbean food on the menu. But then they also had a display of historical Black figures, and they only had people from the Black liberation movements in America. So Black Americans like, you know, Martin Luther King, etc. Of course, they didn't have Malcolm X. But it just, I think stress, especially in the UK, of seeing anti-racism and you know, fighting against anti-Black racism is something that predominantly comes from America, or talking about it in the UK from a US context allows people to just act like it doesn't happen here, that we don't have it like that bad, that it's not an issue in this country as much as it is in the US. It's like, at least our police isn't doing what they did. But they are. They are killing people in the streets in the UK, in France. I mean, there was a 15-year-old boy that was just killed in France by police. This is everywhere. And it's everywhere because the majority of the world was colonized by Europeans. And the other part were the Europeans that did the colonizing. There's not many people that escaped this, or we're not a part of this. So every institution is based on that colonization that resulted in racism. I can't even remember who said it or who's, you know, like who coined this, you know, idea, but a lot of the injustices in the world come from three big systems: patriarchy, capitalism, and colonialism. And I think we can't dismantle one without dismantling the others. These things are, you know, they seem like they're big forces that can never be broken down, but if we do start talking about the different ways that they exist and then the different contexts, but then also have collaborations between people, you know, US and the UK, there's a lot, and you know, in Africa and in Asia, like there's a lot of things that we can talk about between diaspora and natives in countries that were and still face the ravages of colonialism. The things that we definitely need to share ideas and, you know, join each other in our liberation movements, and these things have existed for a really long time. Like, for example, I remember, I think it was 2021, so a year after the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement movement when George Floyd was killed, Palestine was under attack, like really heavy attack by Israel. And on Twitter, there was a lot of collaboration where Palestinians were getting tips and giving tips to Black protesters in the US about how to avoid tear gas and how to like protect yourself from cameras and things like that. And it was, I think social media really has helped us so much, and we're going to start to see a big attack on social media because of the way that it's helped us in these, you know, collaborations that we're doing. Because when I was a child, when I was, you know, a teen, and I was getting into these reading and learning and talking to my friends and knowing about all these liberation movements, it was within our little context. But then now we feel more confident talking about it out loud, and we've got the language so we can call out the violence that we experience every day in our lives in a way that we never did when we were in schools.
I mean, this is such a big subject, and we didn't even touch on social media in the beginning, right? Like, I mean, where I found these definitions, I went straight to the internet. So even the where I had this, I don't know if I would have been able to go into a library to find the definitions that I found on the internet to start this conversation. I mean, I don't know if Princess, if you have anything that you wanted to add. I saw you nodding along, so I just didn't want to move us on if you had things that you wanted to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think Henry made some amazing points. And yeah, specifically in the UK, kind of thinking through and talking about racism and just race and all of these, you know, violences and kind of forms of oppression, it's so infantile. And it's not because we don't have brilliant thinkers here. It's not because people don't want to do the work. It's because, you know, so much racism stifles the progression of anti-racist scholarship, of anti-racist thought, of anti-racist living. And so, you know, so I think for us, like, we are stuck having, you know, so even in kind of thinking through, you know, applying these definitions from America here and stuff like that, like I think in actually doing that, like, we're probably going to be incredibly slow and just, you know, kind of hold back because we don't even have the real space to kind of think and to imagine how applying these definitions here in the UK can actually look like and feel like, you know, like we like racism and it just kind of like what's the word? Sorry, my English is not Englishing today, but you know, it's like it's kind of like squatting, you know, and kind of really slowing down and real intellectual and like social and ethical approaches. So I just you know, and so I think in terms of kind of thinking through how racism actually exists here in the UK and like how we can lend, borrow, and also relatively apply these like ideas and also definitions from America, I think we need to do some work to actually prepare our soil, otherwise these seeds won't touch, right? Like these things won't grow into big trees that are developing now. Like, they will either die or they will kind of grow, be sponges. You know what I mean? Like, and I'll tell you right here. So one of my favorite African American thinkers, she is a physician and scholar. Her name is Kamara Phillip-Jones. So a lot of her work is actually to do with them, like, explaining racism. And there's this article she wrote a few years back, and I stumbled across it when I was in my third year, and it's called The Gardener's Tale. And I don't know who is listening, but you have to read that paper immediately. Like it's, I think it will really transform and helps all reimagine like what racism and also anti-racism look like. She uses these allegories and stories to actually really explain in depth and in really fascinating nuanced ways how racism actually exists and also how we can transform and actually into anti-racism. So yeah, Kamara Phillips-Jones, The Gardener's Tale. Read it, cite it, show her some love. Okay.
Yeah, we saw her live speak live as well.
We were standing. Oh my god, auntie, you're killing it. She's amazing. I just have so much.
She remembered you, Princess. You saw her again, didn't you?
I did. I just she's amazing.
So we'll make sure we put a connection, a link in the notes to this.
Please do. Yeah. And just really quickly, I think the second point I wanted to make was linked to social media. So specifically on Twitter, I don't know if it's still a thing right now, but like in the past few days, like Twitter has basically announced this like tweet viewing cap, where I think like people who like don't pay, like non-blue tick, that's people who like don't have the blue tick are limited to actually seeing 600 tweets a day. And then people with the blue tick, I think like 6,000 or something. It's not just, you know, a kind of random thing that Twitter are now kind of stifling like viewing tweets, especially within a time where Twitter and other, I guess, like social media forms like are actually used for I guess like mobilizing and sharing and it's actually a resource for environment and fighting back and talking. And so yeah, 100%, I think that social media plays a real integral part, you know, in terms of how we, I guess, like protest, of how we speak up, and also of like how we actually learn, you know what I mean, of how we communicate, of how we find global communities, you know what I mean, you know. And so yeah, I do think that social media has to be, I think, one, respected more, especially within academic circles. I think that a lot, I won't name names, I think, you know, really and truly, I think especially amongst the older generation of academics, I think they look down upon social media and kind of see it as just the place where, sure, people just share their opinions. But no, like Gen Z especially, Gen Z especially has reimagined what social media can actually do and be as like a tool, you know. And so yeah, I think that yeah, we just have to really respect social media use more. And yeah, I think there's a lot to be explored in terms of how we can continue utilizing it in order to, I guess, like do more and actually enact anti-racism in practice, and also and pastorally for various but also related struggles across the world. So yeah, that's all. Those two small points I wanted to share.
I mean, that's what we're here to do, to share. So please carry on sharing. And I think now I'm actually going to go into institutions like racial disparities in higher education. It is generally accepted that Russell Group universities in some respects provide better prospects for students than non-Russell Group universities, yet Black students attend Russell Group universities in much lower numbers. Why do you think this happens, and how can we question why the number of these students varies at different types of universities? When I say Black students, this data has been looked at over years. So in the past, everybody who was non-white was classified as Black. So some of this hasn't been separated out, like kind of pre the different classifications. So this is like over time. So it could actually be different amongst like different racial groups, but we don't have that data.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that goes down to what it takes to get in. You could start with private school. If you go to private school, you're a higher chance of actually going to a group university or university in general. And if you go to private school, you probably have enough, or your family has enough disposable income to be able to do that. So again, finances, that's like one of the biggest things that will affect how likely you are to get into higher education, and then also how well you do, because university is expensive. And it's not, you know, just because you get a loan doesn't mean like there's not other expenses and there's not other things that you will worry about. There's lots of people that still need to have part-time jobs, and that means you spend less time, you know, studying, so you don't end up doing as well. And you know, getting into university is one thing, but doing well in university is a whole other thing. And especially like if I talk from med school perspective, disproportionately Black students and brown students end up having to resit a lot more, end up dropping out a lot more. And it's interesting because it's really obvious if you know each other. So, you know, if you're in med school and, you know, your friends are in that group and they look around and they see other Black and brown students that aren't like, you know, failing or having to resit. And then when you go to the staff and you say, oh, this is a problem, like we should look into this, they're like, oh, really? Oh, I didn't notice. And it's, you know, it's like, where are you living? Like, what are you looking at? Like, what's happening? Like, obviously there's things going on, and these people are not, they're not dumb, they're not like incapable of being doctors. They very much can do it and once they graduate they become amazing doctors and they do amazing things, but they're just unsupported. They might not have had as many mentors, as many opportunities. You know, in med school I had been struggling for 5 years to even get a mentor, and I would say quite an ambitious person and I know what I want to do, but these opportunities aren't open. And just just knowing, like after I left med school, knowing that, for example, if you joined certain societies like rugby or like hockey or whatever, these little societies within med school, their older years would give you exam prep stuff that they wouldn't give to anyone else. But in order to even be accepted into that and feel comfortable going, most of the time you'd have to be white, but you definitely need to drink. And if you were Muslim and you didn't drink, or if you didn't drink for any reason, or if you just didn't like those, you know, environments, you had no chance of being in these groups. Leaving med school, you know, we realized we just didn't have as many resources. Like, they were hogged. So that was like the thing. And then also, you know, the money thing, not having enough money to pay for the extra textbooks, so the extra like exam prep help, or not having the connections to be able to get research published or get those little extra things on your CV, or having to just deal with more stuff in life and that just holding you back, and then people not helping you or the staff not helping you. I've had friends who were told by, so I have a friend who was told by one of the alumni, or not, sorry, not alumni, what am I saying? One of the staff members that deals with, is head of department, tell her when she basically had to reset a year because she was going through depression. He told her, you know, medicine is a machine and you're just a small cog and it's just going to go on without you. So, you know, if you leave, it's not going to really affect anything. You don't have to stay. Why would you say that to somebody who has just suffered with depression and it is affecting them to the point that they couldn't sit their exams? Like, how does that, like, it's cruel. Like, when you talk to more students, the way you realize the way that they have been, you know, if you struggle in any way, mentally or financially, or, you know, life issues get in the way, the cruelty with which you're dealt with is ridiculous. And disproportionately, it's Black and brown people who go through that stuff. When I was in fourth and final year, I was doing this work with anti-racism. And one of the biggest points was, well, people aren't attaining, like the attainment gap is huge. You know, people aren't doing as well in exams, or they're not getting as many opportunities, because it's not just exams. It's like, you know, what you get published, what you extracurriculars you've done, because those things are going to help you get into specialties. And it ended up being that, looking back after I graduated, how many opportunities I missed because I was spending so much time doing anti-racism stuff and basically talking to a wall for nothing, really, like nothing to change. And then, so it's like those extra stresses that people have, how that affects you, and you just end up like just not doing well, because you haven't got the same amount of energy as somebody who has a lot of privilege. With med school, I guess it depends. There's kind of like the management staff. So that'll be made up of, sometimes they are physicians, sometimes they're not. And yes, a lot of them are white. You have the odd people of color, but mainly brown, actually. Looking at it, I don't think that we did have any Black staff that were on management level. If I'm going to be very honest with you, when it came down to talking about racism, the most vitriol I heard was from some of the brown staff. You know, it was they would just be totally against, you know, doing anything about, you know, these issues, because it's not about, there's something that's going around where we're talking about the white snowy peaks of the NHS management. And the thing is that, yes, there are people of color on those, you know, at the high levels of management, but they get there for a reason. And sometimes because they're willing to compromise on certain things. And if you start to, you know, argue, they'll just be like, keep the peace because I made it. It's fine, just keep the peace. So that's one thing. But then we also had like a lot of lecturers, and the majority of them, yes, were white male. I remember one time I was very excited because I saw like one of the lecturers was Black and hijabi. So she's Black and Muslim. And I was like amazed, because that was the only time. It was ridiculous. Like, we never saw like women of color. We never saw like even men of color. Like, it was so rare that they would get those lecturing positions. And I, not to be, you know, rude, but like lecturing in medicine doesn't need you to be very good at teaching, because we had a lot of lecturers who were just really good at what they did, and then they just talk for an hour and then you get nothing out of it. So, you know, it's not about like not being in the right, you know, not having enough qualifications or not, whatever. It's not about that. It's just about like who you know or who has access to those opportunities, who gets told about those opportunities. You know, when you actually get on placement and stuff. You know, the consultants will, it depends what specialty, I guess, but the consultants will be, you know, a bit more, there's a bit more diversity, yes, but it depends on where you are. So for example, because I'm interested in surgery, I'm sure you guys know it's a male dominated field. There are women, but in terms of women of color, it took me a really long time to find a few, and it just paled in comparison to how many were white men. So is the problem with representation as well, depending on what you want to do in medicine, because it's not structured the same way as other courses. I guess other healthcare courses will be the same because you've got the placement aspect, the management aspect, and the, you know, lecturing and teaching aspect. But yeah, it's the higher positions tend to be people who are white or are okay with structures that protect whiteness or white privilege, or it will be the general issues with NHS being that like certain specialties who are traditionally like male dominated stay that way.
Yeah, so I'm a Zambian lady. And so my experience, I think, from sixth form to undergrad to master's to now doing a PhD, I think, is really indicative in many ways of what Black students face within Vassal Group universities. I agree with Hendon that like it's not always about what you know, who you know. And so even if we are intelligent, even if we are chatting, even if we are ambitious, even if we are bright and brilliant, your knowledge is not enough. Because we simply don't have the backing. We don't know people. We don't know who can open certain doors. But I mean, where to even begin? Like, there are so many intersecting reasons, I think, why Black students either don't even want to attend Vassal Group universities, or two, why when we actually enter, there's such a huge attainment gap. And I will say another plug. Oxford has recently began this new research project, and it's the, I think, one of the principal investigators is called Elizabeth Varman. She's amazing. She taught me in one of my methods modules last year and first year. So she kind of, she's proposed this project to actually look into the attainment between undergrad students. And so I've had a few chats with her, and she, I think, you know, she and her team are doing amazing, very discerning about you know, which, who I talk to, like which studies and which initiatives I support when looking or experiences as Black people, because not everyone who claims to kind of care about our disparities is actually genuine. You know, there's a lot of like saviorism, there's a lot of there's just a lot of nonsense that goes on. Okay, so I think one of the best ways I can highlight the, you know, just the real struggles of Black students entering Vassal Group universities is from my own experience. So for more context, I'm working class. I'm like lower working class. I'm from the north of England, from Sheffield. They went to school, secondary school in my local area. I'm like, you know, it's kind of within the quote unquote inner city. I mean, I love my teachers and friends, but, you know, like, it wasn't a quote-unquote good school. And so then when it came to year 11 and I was looking at sixth form, and so even back then, I knew that, like, in terms of getting into higher education, I'd have, like, a greater chance if I did sixth form instead of college, right? And so, obviously, I ended up getting into this sixth form, which away by bus each way, as in, like, to and from. And so it was super bougie, super middle class, as in, I think in my year 12, in my parents' evening, I actually discovered that one of my mom's, I guess, like, bosses at work, a consultant, sent his son there as well. And so, like, my mom's a nurse, right? And so, yeah, and so a lot of my classmates were children of consultants, you know, making bank, of lawyers, of doctors, of, you know, economists, of just, you know, very, like, middle class, right? And I just wasn't, you know, I was not. And I found that even there, as in, like, planning to actually apply to uni was such a struggle, because they had never experienced that kind of white middle class environment before. And so even just going there in terms of trying to increase my chances of higher education, it nearly cost me everything. Like, when I tell you, again, at the time I didn't have this language, because back then in 2014 to 2016, the topic of mental health was just beginning to kind of enter the kind of discourse, but it wasn't nearly as it is now. That I developed crippling anxiety, and now I understand and there was a bit of anxiety, and also dare I say, right? So those 2 years, I was fighting for my life every day. At the time, I was like, why do I feel like crying all the time? Why do I feel on edge? Why do I feel like I'm not feel so tired, like I'm lethargic? Like, hey, there's something has gone off psychologically, and I don't know what, can't explain it. But, you know, and kind of being in that environment, I'm not even being dramatic, it nearly killed my chances of actually getting into higher education, right? And so when I was, I think in like late year 12, like early year 13, and we were preparing uni applications, or I think it's like our guidance counselor or like our career person, well, I kid you not, she essentially told me to like aim lower in terms of my uni choices, and that like these Russell groups I was applying to, or rather like planning to apply to, I wasn't smart enough to actually get in. And so, yeah, I 100%, this is not a lie, you guys, I kid you not, that nearly finished me, you know. And so so obviously I'm doing a PhD now at Oxford, so bigs, and mentally I have a custody, it's okay. Anyway, so I think in terms of understanding the actual disparity and also attainment gap, we need to start actually acknowledging like sixth form and the kind of time where we are, you know, like actually doing applications, etc., because I do know that like that time it's so crucial, and obviously it does like where people get in and also where, right? I would talk about so much, and when I mean so much, I mean so much experience of the various issues Black students face, and again, I could talk about it for a long time, so like I won't, but yeah, so yeah, I think like uni is a crucial time to study, and also quickly, I think in my experience, when it comes to the attainment gap from Black students either staying within uni, and also I think achieving actual potential, there's a lot of interpersonal racism, anti-Blackness, and misogyny from fellow students, also members of staff, okay? And then structurally, also in terms of finances, in terms of loans, in terms of just these additional expenses, where a lot of us, like, we are distracted from our work, you know, because we are wanting to kind of navigate how to live the paying rent, you know what I mean? Like legit, you know? And so a lot of these financial stressors kind of exacerbated by interpersonal anti-Blackness, you know, and wider kind of institutional Blackness, which comes from I guess like teaching content, and also a lack of like Black members of staff, etc., you know, as in like our environment when we do our degrees, it's so hostile, it's so toxic, it drains us. And so again, I think in these conversations about attainment and about the like lack of Black students attending, that it is really complex and it's multi-layered. In terms of research, in terms of understanding, it will take time for non-Black people to really understand the extent of like everything we face, and the complexities and the really deeply embedded injustices we face, which I guess like stop us from even trying, you know, never mind actually achieving our potential grades and degrees, you know what I mean? But yeah, like there is just honestly like this specific topic, it requires its own episode, because it's just that's a lot, and what I've shared now is just a snippet. I barely touched that whole surface.
I think that like both of you have touched on kind of like different experiences in terms of mental health as well, which I think is something that's not really talked about. I could talk to both of you forever. How do you know which battles you're going to fight and which battles you won't be fighting?
It's such a good question. And I think it's something that I've had to learn a lot, because I do end up fighting every battle. And the problem is that I do need to be a lot more selective. I have been thinking about this a lot, to be honest. I guess it depends on what's motivating me at the point. Not proud to say this, but a lot of my motivation is like anger. You know, if I'm angry about a situation, it makes me want to do something about it, pushes me to stick with something a bit more. So I guess it depends, you know, if it makes me more angry, I'll probably fight that even if I don't think about it too much. But it's like thinking about, you know, what is the outcome? Like, what am I going to gain from having this conversation? What's going to happen? Like, is anything going to change? I think if we start to think about it that way, is anything going to change? I guess it depends. If you're a pessimist, it might just demotivate you. But again, if you are an angry, stubborn person, you might just fight every battle and then burn out. Like, you know, I think having a little circle of people you trust, people who are in the same fight in the same boat as you, that you can talk to about it, is really important. That's the way that I have dealt with these things. I have, you know, close friends that I will talk to about these situations, or we'll be doing the work together. And then we decide together, because we can talk about it, be a bit level-headed and give each other advice. Is it worth fighting this battle? Is it worth, or what's a way that we can do it where at the end we don't end up suffering because of picking this particular fight? And I've seen a lot of people, just especially with racism, in the face of racism, deciding not to fight that particular battle, especially in the situations where it's interpersonal, and especially when it's from a teacher or someone who's higher up, someone who's lower down, and deciding just not to pick that fight. And, you know, people could say, well, if you don't pick that fight, like, nothing's going to change. But at the end of the day, you have to put yourself first. And sometimes the institution is so bad, you know, if you go through that whole thing, it will just make everything so much worse for you. You will experience much more racism in the process of complaining. And that's something that a lot of people have experienced, you know, in academia, in the NHS, in, you know, for whatever institution that you're in, you experience much more gaslighting and more of the racism or the misogyny or whatever it was in the process of complaining than you did at the start. And it's awful. But I guess that is one battle. But another battle you could pick is the longer war, if you will, in terms of making sure that if you do complain, it's not, you know, you're actually listened to, and that those things don't happen in the first place. And I guess I felt I had the stamina to be able to do that. So when people couldn't complain, rather than making them complain, it would just be something that, or convincing them to complain or do, like, take it further, it would just transform into, what can we do to make it so that this, you don't feel this way? It's just changing kind of what the battle is sometimes. But yeah, it is really important, because yeah, you have to balance your own mental health, and you can't blame people for not picking certain battles. If you're willing to do it, great. But yeah, it's a big topic.
Recently, I'll say, just keeping it real, I still don't know. I'm still figuring it. Like, I'm very much a person who's like, you know, especially when it comes to injustice, or what I think is injustice, that's not necessarily good advice. What I will say is that our supervisor, Thomas Cousins, shout out to Thomas, when we had our very first supervision, he gave me a good piece of advice which has never left me. His advice was to trust my gut. Like, he told me to trust my gut. That was the first time anyone in this life had ever told me that. You know, he told me to, you know, one thing about this default journey, whatever, is to trust your gut. And so I think when it comes to figuring out which battles we will fight and which battles we won't, which things we will compromise on and which things we will confirm in, I think it's important to trust gut, you know? And for me, that gut is not the head and the gut is not the heart. So it's not a case of just going with your head, going with your gut. No, your gut. I feel like there's a certain instinct which is so innate. It's not taught. It's not necessarily socialized. It's just within us, right? Like, we know, you know what I mean? And so, yeah, if your gut is telling you to kind of choose to go to fight, or to choose peace or to compromise, I think we should listen to that. I think I would, something my primary supervisor has done in the past, you know, when obviously reading my work and giving feedback, is to ask me about, you know, imagining just like a kind of more hopeful future, and if, you know, doing the imagining is even possible, right? And so I think, you know, I've definitely been inspired and really challenged to not just, I guess, in one sense, have like tunnel vision, and to not be resigned to thinking that everything is like hopeless and that things can't improve, because I think they 1,000% can. You know, holding on to hope and holding on to, you know, a kind of improved future is, in my opinion, a part of the work of challenging racism and violence. And so I think to the next guest, I would definitely ask, like, what kind of futures are you imagining and are hoping for? In what ways do you think that they are achievable?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great question. Great place to leave it on. Thank you so much for being on this
Thanks for having
podcast.
me, tired brain of mine. But yeah, it's been fun.
Conversation has been so enriching. Thank you for giving up your time, for being just honest and sharing and answering the questions so thoughtfully as well.
Thank you so much for
So much
having
for having
us.
us.
In today's podcast, we talked about equality, equity, and liberation, social media. We compared definitions of anti-racism in the US and if this can be applied to the UK context. We then went through examples of individual, interpersonal, institutional, and structural racism, with Hendon Princess sharing their personal experiences in Russell Group universities in the UK. We had such a rich discussion. Unfortunately, there was so much we couldn't include everything in this podcast, but it was such an enriching and insightful conversation. I'm so grateful to Princess and Hend for their time. Thank you so much for listening to the Power and Privilege in Academia podcast, brought to you by Black and Brown in Bioethics. Be sure to visit blackbrownbioethics.blogs.bristol.ac.uk to listen to more of our podcasts, follow our work, and connect with our network. Credits. Thank you to the Centre for Ethics in Medicine at the University of Bristol and to the Ethox Centre at the University of Oxford for all their support. Thank you to Dr. Kasim Ashra for providing intro and outro beats.